So yeah, thanks to Gurley and Mina for the invitation, and everybody for the very nice visit so far. It's been a lot of fun. And yeah, so I just wanted to have this slide up. So in case anybody hasn't seen this, Hinchliffe's rule is that if the title of a paper is a yes or no question, then the answer is no. And so the underlying point is that if someone has the question, then they don't really have a lot of evidence for it. So with that in mind, here's the title of the talk. Is self-interacting dark matter undergoing dark fusion? It's definitely like kind of a speculative thing, but I think it's kind of a fun example if nothing else, and I think there's a good bit to be learned along the way. So here's the outline. I'll do the very brief introduction that people may have seen things before. I'll talk about what I mean when I say self-interacting dark matter. I'll talk about the velocity dependence of self-interacting dark matter, and then I'll get to some speculative ideas later. So the introduction. This is just the very big picture slide, so people here are probably familiar with this, but we're at colliders. We've gone through the electroweak scale. We found the Higgs. We kind of have this complete model of things in terrestrial experiments, but there's just a whole lot of big particle physics questions that we don't know the answer to, that we are hopefully making some progress on, but the basic fact is that we have this kind of one kind of complete sector and one whole bunch of other unexplained facts that we're still trying to understand. So the question is, where is the new physics? Where is the stuff that explains everything in this paragraph? Let's take one step back and say, let's just run the thought experiment. What if the universe was the Standard Model and nothing else? Then we would take a look out at the galaxies and cosmology, and on the largest scales, everything would be gas, stars, galaxies, clusters, and we would be able to learn, all the things about a given galaxy or a given place in the universe by looking at galactic dynamics and structure, and we would see how fast things were moving and how the things in the galaxies were arranged, and we could learn that just by looking at the kind of light that the galaxies emit and absorb, and we would count up how many stars there were, how much gas there was, all that, and we would have some concrete predictions for how the largest scale structures should behave. So there's a pretty concrete prediction that if there is no dark matter, then most of your mass is contained inside a relatively small radius, and outside of that radius, the velocity. So this is V sub c is the circular velocity of an object in a galaxy. That's square root of gm over r. So once you get past the point where most of the mass is contained, then there would be this characteristic turnover point. And so stuff out there would be moving slower because r is getting bigger. But of course, we know that that's not really what's going on. And in fact, if you take detailed measurements, you see something that's at least somewhat flat. There's some structure, but it doesn't turn over in that qualitative way that we expected. And this was that's Wiki. This data is not from him. Sorry?
He's very upset about the missing.
Yeah, I mean, this is the face of a guy who.
That's a picture of him, by the way.
Yeah, he doesn't want this to be true, but it is true. So there's missing mass that is needed to explain the rotation curves, and that's where we got our first hint of what dark matter was. So the stuff out here, this flat stuff, I'll refer to in the rest of the talk as the halo, and so this is the velocity out here is given by the structure of the halo. And the velocities in here, so there's not many data points in this particular measurement, but the velocities at very low radii, those are determined by the inner structure And so I'll have more to say about that in a few slides. So so there's this stuff out there, you know, dominating the halo, determining the structure of the halo at large, very large radii. And that stuff, we call it dark matter. The things that we know about it are listed here. So it has to be present for a very long time. It was there in the early universe and formed gravitational potential wells that standard model stuff fell into and then, you know, allowed galaxies and things to form. And we know that it interacts more weakly with electromagnetic radiation than the standard model does, just by looking at the kinds of features that there are in the spectrum, in the power spectrum. So how many objects there are per size. So there'd be many more features in that if that wasn't true. So this is, you know, this is quite a bit of information just from you know, looking out at the at these like very gross qualitative features of the halos. But you know, obviously we would like to know a lot more. So as particle physicists, the kinds of things that we, you know, typically think about are these first several at least. What's the mass? What are the interaction channels? So like what ways does it interact? How strong are those interactions? Does it have any friends? Is there a sector that it's a part of? How is it produced? Was it in thermal equilibrium at some point? Was it not? And then kind of that goes along with that is what's the large scale arrangement? So what are the real details of how the dark matter is everywhere? So are there any hints that we can work with? That's the question. That should not have a no answer, but this is just a subsidiary question. So. Answer is yes, there are some hints. So I'll talk about some of those hints now. So this is a picture of dark matter particles in the early universe, and there's an overdensity of 10 to the minus 5 in the middle here. If you look really closely, count it up. I saw those points very, very carefully. And that overdensity of 10 to the minus 5 grew to clump in the middle. So the gravitational interactions became stronger and forced some accumulation of things in the middle. And what we find when we run many simulations of this kind of behavior many, many times is that across many scales of size, all of the dark matter halos roughly have, as a function of the radius r away from the center of this bulge, as a function of r, they have a density profile, rho, that looks like this. So in the inside, inside of a scale radius, which I'm going to call r sub s, inside of that radius, the density increases like 1 over r as you go to smaller r. And outside of that radius, as you go to larger r, it falls like r to the minus 3. So this is what you find if dark matter only has gravitational interactions and all it does is just, you know, start to attract itself very slowly over a long time.
This is not a good variant, though, right?
That's right, yeah. So things would change if you had baryons. Another way that things could change from this picture of things clumping up in the middle is if you had some self-interactions. So the center is a little bit more dense than in this picture. And I counted it all very quick, very, very carefully, so it's exactly even density in the middle. Very hard, took a long time. But Joe can verify, Joe counted it as well.
Oh yeah.
I see. And so what you find is if dark matter has self-interactions, that the energy gets distributed, gets shared amongst all those particles, and you have a core where inside of this scale radius or core radius, things are flat, and then outside of it, the density falls.
Okay. What's RS? Sorry.
RS is just a, you know, some radius where this behavior changes. Yeah. So different size objects will have different RS, but and different rho S. So the value of rho at that radius is different for a galaxy cluster as opposed to like a satellite galaxy, but the kind of key finding from these kinds of simulations is that you can characterize them just by those two things. You don't need to additionally characterize them by these power laws or by multiple regions. You kind of have two different things.
I know it'd be like the NFW formalism. RS is strictly defined as the radius at which the density slope is like minus one. The density is going like R to the minus one. So.
The NFW density profile is 1 over x times 1 plus x squared.
But
it's just the sum of the product of those things.
Yeah.
At that exact radius, if you the derivative is slightly more than 1.
The RS radius?
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. It's not, here it's asymptotically far away from RS.
Oh, you're right. I think it's minus 2 or something.
It's closer to minus 2, yeah. So for the Ionesto profile, you have R sub minus 2. And so that's defined because the slope is close to
You're right.
It's negative 2, it's not. Yeah, but for NFW, it's, I want to say like 2.2, but it's close. Good. So this is dark matter with self-interactions. And it has this core profile. And that moves forward, good. Now I'm calling it R. Oh yes. I'm gonna call this, there's this characteristic radius R1. Inside of R1, I'm gonna assume that things behave like this isothermal thing. So I'm assuming for the rest of the talk that there are some self-interactions that cause the dark matter to share energy and thermalize. So inside of R1, the density profile is isothermal. Outside of R1, the density profile is that NFW 1 over R cubed. Good, and so now you can ask, what would determine R1? Like, what would determine that characteristic radius inside of which things get thermalized? And you can just have a simple criterion where you take the number density for an NFW profile, for example, and you multiply it by some cross section times V, multiply that by the age of however long the object has existed, and that will give you when that's equal to 1, then that means that inside of that radius, on average, things have interacted once. So finding R1 in an object, so you can go out and look observationally where things seem to be flat, and then when they transition to falling off with radius. And finding R1, where that transition occurs, is equivalent to finding a cross-section sigma v. Is that kind of clear? So you can go out and you can look for R1. Once you do that, then you have some idea of how strongly the particles there are interacting.
TH is what?
The age of the object. So clusters formed more recently than small things did.
Where's the age of the cluster instead of the dynamical time scale, like the infill time?
Those will be similar.
For these things, they're similar?
Yeah. Okay. Because that's that kind
so,
of.
So small that.
This is for a cluster. This is something like several billion years, like 5 billion years.
But the infill time is usually, at least in our galaxy, like 1 million years. You can calculate
root
how long it takes to with a velocity of 10^-3 to cross the galaxy, right? That's the infill time.
So it should go parametrically like root zero.
They are more dilute, so it takes longer.
They're large. Here, they're very large. Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. Sorry. Yes.
Yeah. I mean,
they're bigger. I have to think about the velocity in my head. Yeah. I cannot recall from.
But
it must be less, right? Because
there are a few things at play, right? Because you have to merge some subgalaxies in order to make the Milky Way galaxy. It might not just be as simple. Just having our whole galaxy collapsing, because that's not how it happened, right?
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah. Another way just to think is that, this is something that should be we wanted to be in place at the time that, that you know, we see these things being, you know, in their present state. Okay, so good. So finding this R1 tells you some sigma v. The way that you find R1 is you can look and you can find velocities of objects at very small radii. So this goes back to that kind of early picture that I had with Zwicky. So this is that inner structure, and this is, you know, several, you know, five measurements inside of 10 kiloparsec of the velocities of objects there. And I'm not sure if you can see, but there's a faint blue line or light blue line here corresponding to the NFW profile. So if the dark matter had an NFW profile, you'd expect the velocities to be centered on the blue, but instead they're centered on this orange. And so you can take more measurements and you can find out when these things start to overlap again, and that's where R1 is inside of that. Isothermal seems to fit. And so this was all shown, and a lot of this talk will be based on work that these guys did, Manoj Kaplinghat, Sean Tulin, who's not far from you guys over in New York, and Haibo Yu. So they showed all this, and they did this for more than just one object. They did this for something of order 10 or 15. I won't count them all in front of you, but the colored points are all objects that one observes, and the central value is some best fit, you know, velocity and some best fit sigma v, and so where this velocity is some characteristic velocity of the object, which you can interpret as, you know, characteristic mass of the object, and they do this and they find the points that look like that.
Why is there? What are the green points? They're so different than the other ones.
So those are at much higher velocity, and so these are all galaxy clusters. And these ones, which are at low velocity, so like down to 20 or 30 kilometers a second, these guys are dwarfs, dwarf galaxies, or dwarf, yeah. And the blue ones are low surface brightness galaxies, which are more amenable to getting this kind of velocity measurement.
So is there something special about the Abel cluster, because it had a velocity down in like the
Deep inside, so at one kiloparsec.
Hang out at like 100 kiloparsecs.
Yeah.
It picks back up to like 1,000.
Exactly.
That's going to give you the average.
That's one of those.
Yeah.
So I don't know if it's Vmax or V. Yeah. But this is some velocity that characterizes the thing, the total size or shape.
Maybe some, sorry, but we have a model where we have a velocity-dependent cross-section.
That's what that's where we're going. Let me see. Now my computer is too far away to actually see what I was trying to remind myself to say. I think I said it all. We'll get there in like 2 slides. Right. And so just as like a note, I'm going to be using centimeters squared per gram throughout a lot of the talk. And that's roughly a barn per GeV, and a barn 10 to the minus 24 centimeters squared. That's kind of like the nuclear scale, which nucleons hit each other. Okay, so this is like normal, you know, this is standard model nuclear cross-section size for self-interactions. It's big. Okay. Yes, so now we are going to talk about the velocity dependence.
Are you still assuming the dark matter is heavy here? What are you assuming for the dark matter, I guess?
The thing that matters is...
The ratio of the mass. No, the thing I'm...
Yeah, sigma over m.
Yeah, but what I'm... If you have such strong interaction cross-sections, don't they affect like BBN and things like that, or in the early universe? I mean, these are huge cross-sections. They are not...
These are just amongst themselves, so it's just for self-interaction.
Oh, I guess what I was thinking is affecting structure at small scales. Not even cores and galaxies now that you have strong structure, but do they affect the spectrum?
So that's right. Yeah, so that's a good question. So there's a nice paper by Kfir and Cora Dvorkin and Mark Kiminkowski, and they do... the constraints for all these things, and they're kind of at the same That you where you can't have a self interaction. Actually, no, that's this interaction with the standard model. Haibo and Manoj have a paper more recently where they look at the effects on the power spectrum and what you'd expect. And I mean, they find that this stuff is consistent, and you might find some hints as you get, you know, better Lyman alpha data or something like that. But so you're looking at stuff that's very, very small structures.
You have to assume that sigma v over m somehow velocity dependent, right? Based on this plot.
Well, that's what I'll talk about next.
But yeah. In the early universe, they were moving much, much faster. So here, the cross section would be smaller, I guess, the way it's going here.
For these guys, yeah. So yeah, I'll talk about all that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So the.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, it's
velocity dependent.
It's important. Yeah. That's what the paper is about, and the remaining 60% of the talk. Certainly ask me questions if it's not clear in a couple slides. So the key question to be asking, I think, is what is causing the dark sector energy redistributions? So, like, what kind of a cross-section is it? So there are logically, correct me if I'm wrong, two possibilities. It's either elastic scattering or not. I've classified it, and if it's inelastic, then there are a couple possibilities, and it's either that you're releasing a lot of energy or you're not releasing a lot of energy. So I'll go through all these possibilities. So good. So let's start off with the idea that this is elastic scattering, and there is a massive mediator, and so there will be some dependence on velocity because I'm going to tune the mass of the mediator to be around the mass of the dark matter times the characteristic velocity of a galaxy. Okay? At v dwarf, which is less than v galaxy by definition, then q galaxy, which is m dark matter times v, is going to be smaller than m phi. I can ignore that, and this is just a contact interaction, and so it's just, you can, you know, ignore the prefactors. We're only interested in the velocity dependence. So if I drop the q, then it's just n sigma v just goes like v. And the opposite limit, where I'm moving much, much faster than this special scale, then I drop m phi, now I've got v to the fourth in the denominator, and so I have that scaling for n sigma v. So this is just to make it explicit. This is what's happening in their model, and they have a much, you know, more comprehensive way of, you know, getting the cross-section, but this is just works at the order of magnitude level. So what you require is that, you know, you have a mediator whose mass is like this number, so like a few hundred kilometers a second times the dark matter mass. Down here, it's just a contact interaction. Up here, it's basically a massless mediator. So that's
some. But don't the light gray points exclude this curve?
Those are not observations. Those are simulations. So by hand, they do an in-body simulation with a self-interaction cross-section of exactly 1 centimeter squared.
But there's those with error bars. Those are not observations either.
So what they do, yeah. So what they do is they put in a simulation with that cross-section, and then they use their technique to see what preferred value of sigma v they get.
Oh, I see.
So they know what the answer is, and then they're showing you how good their error bars are. So they're kind of characteristically overestimating it. About 1 sigma or something.
Okay, so it's a simulation, it's not a measurement.
So,
but the rest are measurements.
Everything else is a measurement, yeah.
Okay.
In the sense that it's not a direct measurement of sigma v, but yeah, everything else comes from.
If you were to translate what you saw as an effect of self interactions, what would that?
Yep, you go out, you look at all these things, you find R1, and then you get sigma v.
Okay, why would they include?
They're just doing that to show you that their error bars are, that this technique of extracting sigma v works kind of at the one sigma level. So they know, in this case they know that the answer is one is yeah, like they know that it's 1 centimeter squared. Maybe these each get paired with the circle, the open circle.
But this is also assuming the baryons do nothing to the structure, right? So the baryons do not affect the structure.
No, they include baryons. They do Monte Carlos that include varying over baryonic mass to light ratios. Mm-hmm. So you get some certain amount of baryon information. Not sure exactly how they take care of that in the simulations, but I think that they do some hydro stuff.
I remember they don't do like the full baryonic feedback with supernova energy injection per unit baryonic mass. Instead, they're taking the results of other studies and they're using that to sort of fit phenomenologically the effect of baryons.
That sounds right to me.
Yeah.
But that sounds right to me, but I'm not absolutely sure. Okay, so is this good? I mean, this is also my first time giving this talk on this paper, so any feedback is good. Okay, so and about half of the talk is actually their paper, so I want to make sure that I'm explaining it clearly. Good. Okay, so this is the massive mediator example, and yes, so now I'll just go through the kind of pros and cons. So this, you know, this does provide a mechanism for a different sigma v across objects of different size. So that seems to be something that you want, but it requires, you know, a numerical coincidence. Maybe it's not the worst numerical coincidence that you've ever seen, but still, why is it that m phi is v dwarf times the mass of the dark matter? Good. So now I'll kind of just go take a step back and talk about where the velocity dependence can come from more generally. So the cross section, the sigma for 2-to-2 scattering, has this flux factor and then this stuff that depends on the particle physics. So matrix element squared is all the things that you're normally calculating with Feynman diagrams. S is the centered mass energy, and then this just tells you how to relate the stuff that comes out from the stuff that goes in. And so in the non-relativistic limit, I hope that you'll let me just write MV. I don't have to derive that. And the point that is kind of just, you know, if there's one message from the talk, is that this thing up top scales like v at all velocities. It can scale like v at all velocities only if the scattering is exactly elastic. If it's elastic, so and these stars, these mean in the center of mass frame. So if it's elastic, then the particles go in and come out with the exact same velocity. And so in general, that doesn't have to be true if the masses of the particles change during the interaction. So one case that you're already familiar with is annihilation. So in that case, let me assume that there's no phase space suppression. This is uncompressed annihilation. So the momentum of the thing that goes out is basically the mass of the thing that came in. All right. And so that has no velocity dependence in it at all. And what that means is that the cross-section for annihilation goes like 1 over v, or sigma times v for annihilation is constant. And that happens because there's a different velocity dependence of p out and p in. So let's see what that does to an object. So if you have the dark matter, the cold dark matter annihilating. So this is from a paper back in 2000. You see that you have an effect. You do the same coring, you change the density profile at the center, and you have a different size of the effect for an object of a different size. Okay. So that's this is something that, has exactly the features that we would want based on Sean and Ibonez's more recent stuff. So if I drew that on this plot, I would have exactly the same sigma v everywhere. And this kind of seems to fit the observations with their error bars basically as well as this dotted orange line, which is that massive mediator model. So this dotted orange line, this massive mediator, the thick black line, is annihilation. And it's giving you the exact same sigma v across objects of all different masses. The same extracted sigma v. So the issue here is that annihilations are kind of, you know, irreversible. You annihilate, you go to something light that carries away tons of energy, and then you have depleted the number of dark matter particles that you have. So what they say in their 2000 paper is that the, you know, to ensure that early annihilations do not reduce the cold dark matter particles to negligible numbers, because again, you know, things are exponentially sensitive to this this cross section, they must be protected against annihilation in the early universe, and the requirements on a model for annihilating cold dark matter are stringent, but by no means impossible. Just to say that 10 to the minus 17 centimeters cubed per second is a large cross section. That's, you know, much, much larger than the thermal cross section, which is like 10 to the minus 26. Okay. So the annihilations, you know, they've got pros and cons. So this, you know, thing that I kind of hinted at earlier, this naturally explains constant sigma v, and that kind of seems to be what the data is pointing at. The data doesn't have, you know, some lower thing and then some peak and then something that turns off. The data just looks kind of flat. So annihilations explain that. That's cool. But all of the fuel is gone. There's the ways around that are, you know, to somehow have mass varying final states or some late time decays or things that just make the problem worse, in my opinion. If you want to not deplete every single dark matter particle, you can make it asymmetric dark matter, but then by definition, there's no antiparticles left at the end of the day. So maybe you can give stuff with small Majorana mass, and then it turns back into the antiparticle later on. This is something that people have talked about, but that's kind of, you know, you need to have a very long lifetime for the oscillations for that to happen. And so there are ways to do it, but it's, I, you know, this is all a little bit of a stretch to me.
And none of this discussion takes into account how you produce the dark matter in the first place.
So this is a problem if they're thermal relics, I guess.
If they have some temperature comparable to our sector, I guess, but...
Yeah, I mean, this is 9 orders of magnitude higher than the thermal cross section, so it's okay. you'd have to do something pretty extreme, I think. Yeah, I mean, I won't. Yeah, maybe necessarily depleted is a little bit strong, but yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Hey, you said it on your slide, so I don't need to say it. The last bullet.
Cool. So, okay, so now what the title of the talk actually is, so it's a dark fusion. So how does that change the situation? So again, Pn is mv, as always. And now P out is something that you can calculate. So you have this, you know, S minus M3 plus M4, S minus M3 minus M4. And now S is M1 plus M2, 1 plus V squared, and then M3 plus M4. So just by definition, I've made it equal to M1 plus M2 times 1 minus B. So I'm releasing a small amount of energy, I'll call it binding energy. And So if I assume that M3 and M4 are kind of the same size as M1 and M2, then this term just turns into like a product of the masses. So that comes out and kind of cancels things and blah, blah, blah. At the end of the day, I have a mass, the mass of the incoming guy times 2b plus v squared. And then this k can either be 1/2 or 1, depending on whether or not what the relationship between M3 and M4 is. But the key point is that I'm comparing b against v squared. And so if b is larger than v squared, then this thing has no velocity dependence. If b is smaller than v squared, then it has a velocity dependence again. So what are the b's and v's that I need? So sigma goes like b raised to the k, again, where k is 1/2 or 1, divided by v at low v. So sigma v is constant at low v, and I, for the same reason as in the annihilation case.
Can I ask a question about the sigma v is constant thing? It's just a basic conceptual, the misunderstanding I was having for a little bit. But if you go back to that slide you had with the different galaxies and sigma v plotted against v. So this black line, it's really that sigma is proportional to 1 over v, so that
yes.
Sigma v plotted against v is a constant.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, yeah. Just because you were asking for feedback on your,
yeah.
When you say sigma v is constant, it's really when you include the 1 over v dependence in sigma, that sigma v is no longer dependent on v. This is the statement.
Yes.
Okay.
That's the statement. Yeah. Yeah, so I could say, yeah, sigma is proportional to 1 over v. They've plotted it as sigma v, and so that makes this point even more clear.
And is this going to depart from them a little bit? I think the data certainly would support this case almost as well as, you know, there are cases where they have the velocity-dependent cross-sections, but it's a little bit of a departure from the sorts of models they're looking at in terms of the dependence on v, right?
For sure. I mean, theirs is the dashed line.
Right, okay.
Mine is basically... black.
We're okay. 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 Sorry. Thank you.
Sure. Do you have a question? Good. So I did a little bit of relativistic or non-relativistic kinematics and wound up with this expression. So sigma has 1 over v dependence at low velocity. Okay. What I'll suggest is that that this cross section is just 1 over m squared, and I'll suggest that b is around 10 to the minus 3, which is something that we see in standard modeled nuclear physics. So just to make that point in some detail, so I mean this is just nice because this is real data. So this energy you can of course interpret as a velocity. On the y-axis, this is just sigma. This is not sigma v. And you can see that there, for all of these cross sections, this is the neutron absorption cross section on these following elements. The solid, I think, is the total cross section, and the dotted are the absorption or inelastic parts of the total. So flat means sigma is constant, and so you can see that flat is elastic scattering, so that sigma has no v dependence at high v, and at low v, sigma goes like 1 over v. The one interesting thing is that the absorption on boron 10 goes to a 3-body final state, so it's not just 2-body, it's not just 2 to 2. 2 to 2 is a little easier to write, but really all this matters is just that it's low velocity, and you'll still get the same behavior. Good, so now it's basically the same plot, slightly different axis ratios, but same data. I got it directly from Ivo. I didn't even have to click million times on a plot, so you can trust it. And same thing with the orange line. And so this sigma v is constant at low velocity, but it doesn't have to be constant, exactly constant everywhere. So at high velocities, the v squared inside of the radical can kind of start to dominate, and so you can get behavior up there. For sigma v that goes like 1 over mdm squared, and b of around 10 to the minus 3, as I was saying earlier, then we find that mdm of around 100 MeV fits this data. So as you would expect, because this is a little bit larger than, you know, the Barn scale, that you need a mass a little bit below what the standard model nuclei are. So I've basically made it fit that, and then added in a little bit of a fudge. It's also interesting, so this is just from the particle physics model building kind of side. The sigma v doesn't necessarily have to go like 1 over m squared. So you might think that, you know, so there's unitarity limits for particles that are just single particles, that you should have 1 over m squared kind of gives you a bound, an upper bound from unitarity on the scattering. But if you have bound state formation, you can have non-perturbative effects that change that by basically MdM over mass of the mediator. So this is dark matter mass times mediator mass in the denominator, which can be a lot larger than 1 over m dark matter squared. You get a lot of powers of alpha, but alpha, if alpha is not tiny, then you don't, not necessarily that bad, blah, blah, blah. And this also allows you to calculate the binding energy. I won't say a whole lot more about that. But yeah, so dark fusion, pros and cons. So this has constant sigma v at small v, or as Joe would say, sigma goes like 1 over v. And the maximally provocative way of saying that is that fusion with small binding energy is compressed annihilation without antiparticles. So two things come in, two different things go out. That's kind of what annihilation is. It's not really the same, but maybe it is, I don't know. That's just nice. So one thing is that because this is exactly constant sigma v, if we don't find any more objects down here, if we're not able to find, you know, the inner structure of objects with 10 kilometers a second, which we might not be able to, but if we can't find anything that's, you know, way bigger, we really be really interesting to find objects in the middle here where this discrepancy between the models can be biggest. So if we can do that, that'd be great. So here is an object with a velocity dispersion. Not sure if you can read that, but between 600 and 800 kilometers a second. This is just some kind of like new catalog of galaxy groups that I was, you know, casually perusing the other day.
So how you haven't discussed at all early universe models, right?
Yeah, so I will continue to not really discuss that, but I'll say a few things about it in a little.
When you say compressed annihilation without antiparticles, is this because you don't want it to be a model where the dark matter is its own antiparticle or has the antiparticle in the halo, because then this cross-section indicates, you know, too much depletion in the early universe?
Yeah.
And so you're thinking about something where you have a relic abundance, but then you're annihilating to a different state that wasn't sort of the lightest, maybe it was. Well,
yeah, you could annihilate to something then that could also annihilate to something else, just that this is kind of, once you start saying all those words, then this becomes maybe a little easier for me, at least, to think about. But I think that those words are exactly isomorphic, you know, to this in terms of the physics content, like the pheno.
We'd actually have to build.
But yeah, the model would be different. Yeah, the model would be different, but I think the pheno would be the same. So that might be. I mean, that's something that I think would be interesting if you had stuff that annihilated and then the next stuff annihilated and then eventually froze out. But I think that you wind up getting with something that's like BBN for annihilations. Anyway, maybe we can talk about it.
Sure.
After.
Yeah.
So the turnover is determined by B.
In this plot? E, yeah, this is determined by B. And if I had that case, so this is M4 of around M3. If M4 is really, really small, like you have, so like neutron proton goes to deuteron gamma.
Yeah.
In that case, this mass relation doesn't really hold. And so that's when that sigma V goes like B to the K.
Yeah, because it depends a lot now what the spectrum of these guys is, right? Because in the early universe, how did you form them? Or are you imagining that there is only a proton and a neutron? Is there a deuteron? Now it depends.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, so
the picture depends a lot on what you assume about the model, right?
Yeah, so
oh, yeah.
Yeah, so okay, so here, yeah, I'll say maybe a little bit more, but this is mostly what I'll have. So I'll just show you the couple pictures, and then we can see if there's still complaints. So the statement is that, yeah, maybe you can have heterogeneous populations that survive and that are still able to bind. Or maybe the maximum thing that you BB into in the early universe is not really the thing, like the highest A that's available. So what I mean by that, I meant to put in another slide from Colvin Turner. So the kind of canonical thing that we learn about BBN is that there's this deuteron bottleneck, and that kind of slows things down. And then you fuse up to helium, and then there's no stable A equals 5 or A equals 8 nuclides. So the protons can't really bind with the helium. The helium can't bind with itself. So you kind of get stuck at helium. And you need to get it beyond that, to get like lithium 7, you need, you know, helium 3 or tritium or something, which isn't around that much. And so I think maybe the lore, or the thing that I kind of internalized from that, was that if only there were A equals 5 and A equals 8, then we would just fuse all the way up or something. And I hadn't really appreciated that even if everything was in equilibrium, even if you had stable A equals 5, A equals 8 states, everything was going on normally, and you fused as far as you could go in the early universe until things fell out of equilibrium just from N sigma V equals Hubble. If you did all of that, you would only get up to carbon. So if that was the case, if you wound up from the early universe with carbon and helium, and maybe, you know, so like if you cut off here, right in the middle of it, or maybe a little bit past, you'd still have some non-negligible amount of helium. So you could have, you know, carbons fuse to each other and make an oxygen and a couple heliums or something like that. Or you could have, you know, heliums and carbons making oxygens or whatever it takes. You'd still have things that are well below the iron peak. So the iron peak is when things kind of get fishy and you can't really, like, it wouldn't be really right for me to say that I could just keep on going past that. So the moral of the story that I take from this is just that that it seems to me generically possible and kind of observed that, you know, stopping part of the way up the fusion chain, exactly the kinds of cross-section that I'm talking about, is pretty reasonable. There's been some work, I mean, not with at all close to the cross-sections I'm talking about, but still, you know, there's been some work in an explicit lattice model. So they actually get masses of different constituents and nuclei from the lattice. These guys did this in 2014. They get these masses and binding energies and stuff, and they run, you know, some BBN-like code, and they find that, you know, there's this heterogeneous mix of the different nucleons. So it depends a little bit on the ratio of fusion to annihilation. So this thing here is fusion, these things are annihilation.
Are these deuteron, pi, and rho?
So the pi and the rho are like a proton and a neutron.
Okay.
Yeah. It is, yes.
Their models. That's an unfortunate choice of names.
It's weird nomenclature, yeah. I think they differ by isospin, an isospin-like thing. So I think that's kind of why.
No, but there is the rho meson and
yeah.
There's
That's
so it's confusing.
Once they've recycled D, they might as well have recycled P and M.
Yeah.
I agree. Yeah, Jokish. So okay, so this is just kind of like an explicit die model where they find something similar.
But what are they assuming for? Are they assuming there is an interaction with us? Because this looks like a freeze out type of thing.
Why you're asking why?
What is the assumption about the coupling to us?
They have a light Higgs, so pi rho goes to d hd, then hd decays to standard model stuff. So that's how they get entropy out. So it's a normal. It's like a yeah. So the binding, they've actually cooked it up so that the binding energy is exactly equal to the mass of that thing, so they're kind of right on threshold for that to happen.
Oh, really? What happens if you're not on threshold?
You could make it a little bit more massive, and then you'd have it shut off, or
If
or you could make
it much massless. Why does it have to be? Why don't make it massless? Or, well, I guess there's the issue of naturalness. It's a Higgs.
Yeah, I mean, but so that's essentially my model. It's the one where it's close, where it's far below the binding energy. So. Yeah, so this, I mean, I don't want to overinterpret exactly what this means for my kind of model, but in one model, it does seem to give you some interesting yields.
I don't know, I'm just trying to understand how many gradients you need to get this.
Yeah, there are some interesting kind of Occam's razor questions, you know, like, is the simple thing to just have another thing that's like the standard model, or is the simple thing to have some quantum field theory ingredients that we think are kind of basic to quantum field theory? I don't know. I mean, I think it's a matter of taste, and I can understand the what's not appealing about it.
You do need the binding energy of your dark nuclei to be much less than the mass of these dark constituent particles, whatever you're...
Yeah, I mean, the amount of energy release does... Yeah, that has to be small, but it doesn't have to be... I mean, so the annihilation case is the one where the binding energy release is 1, and it still kind of works. Mm. So you could... I chose 10 to the minus 3 because that's the standard model number, but it could be higher. The thing that's constant is, sigma b to the k over m. I was modeling sigma as 1 over m squared. So it's like b to the, is either root b or b over m cubed is the thing that I want to be 10 to the minus 17 centimeters cubed per gram. Cool. Good. So now we're at the final part. So this is the part that I term speculative ideas. I should maybe call it even more speculative ideas. We've kind of gone through this one. Other ways to avoid what I would call the fuel catastrophes, like you've gotten rid of everything. Maybe somehow the fusion products fall apart. So maybe you made really loosely bound things, and then when they fell back into structures, they got shock heated and fell apart. Just like how the standard model reionizes at late times. The really far out thing would be if there's some CNO cycle, and so you can actually just reuse the constituents as you kind of, I mean, you'd need to have some stable that would make the problem maybe even worse, because you have some, CNO cycles making protons into helium in 4 steps instead of in 1. So maybe this is worse, I don't know. But who knows? I learned about the CNO cycle in order to write that slide. Good. Other signals. So it might be the case that that this sector is coupled to the standard model very, very weakly. That's not what I'm going to say in this slide. Just this is kind of some very minimal other signals that this might have. So even if it's completely entirely secluded, the outgoing states leave with more velocity than they came in with, kind of by definition. That's how how had it work. This can be greater than the escape velocity of small stuff. So in addition, so I would, you know, smooth out the cores of those things, and by smoothing those cores out, I might make it more susceptible to being tidally disrupted or evaporated. And it could be more than what's, you know, around us. So maybe some of the dark matter is warm. And so this would probably look different in
the body. If your cross-section grows so fast with velocity, in the early universe, it would have been much, much more important. So what does it do to small-scale structure? What does it do to density perturbation at small scales?
So the cross-section there goes like 1 over v until you get around the binding energy.
Oh, sorry, I was getting... Oh, it curves up and becomes sigma over m becomes constant.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, either from elastic or.
Yeah. I remember the thing going up, and I was like. Yeah,
that's on a sigma v.
It was tripping me up too.
Yeah, exactly.
The first 5 times I read their paper, I had to stare at that plot many times.
But there is no problem with small scale structure if you have such large cross sections.
I'm saying that one way. But I would affect small scale structure would be to heat them up.
No, but this assumes, I'm talking about in the linear level.
Yeah, I think there would not be in the linear level.
Oh, okay. This would require that you need to get the density high. I don't understand this actually.
So there's a collisional damping scale, and so this would cut off. So there's stuff. There's a kinetic decoupling temperature, in other words, and that would give me some minimum mass. And it's not hard to make it so that minimum mass halo is below what we observe now. So we only see down to 10 to the 8, 10 to the 9 solar masses. And if it's a WIMP, you know, this size of the masses goes down to 10 to the minus 6 solar mass. So I could be very, very different from a WIMP and still be fine. The level of Lyman alpha and stuff, you could maybe start to see it sometime soon. Good. So maybe I can evaporate small objects. Maybe I can solve the missing satellites problem. So this is this is nice. This was something that I thought was really kind of cute. So this is a paper by Annika Peter and I think Andrew Zentner and Mark Kaminkowski are also on it. Good people, and they had this model where the dark matter had a lifetime that was around inverse Hubble, and the dark matter decayed to something very non-relativistically and gave it a really small kick. So if they gave the dark matter a big kick of 100 kilometers a second, which is this green line, you would kind of erase things, you know, all the way up. But if you give it a small kick, you can erase small things but not big things. And so they can kind of reduce the central masses of things and evaporate small stuff. I won't dwell too much on it because after my paper came out, Annika had a new paper which said there is no missing satellites problem. So forget I said anything. Good. Okay. So this is what I was trying to get at. This is on the extremely speculative, very crazy side. So let's assume that everything else that I said is already, you know, satisfied somehow, either through partial BBN or something. Let's say that this dark sector is very weakly coupled to the standard model. So what's an annihilation cross section that I think that I can measure, or I can see, you know, the output from? That is something like the Hooperon, so it's something like a thermal annihilation cross section. That's the annihilation cross section into visible stuff. So if I had this cross section that was mostly going to dark sector things, and sometimes it went to standard model stuff, so I spit off some light mediator, and that light mediator mostly decays to an even lighter dark sector thing, but sometimes it decays to standard model stuff, then I can get 10 to the minus 26 centimeters cubed per second out of 10 to the minus 17 centimeters cubed per second if epsilon is around 10 to the minus 4. So this is an interesting range. Some of the stuff would be, you know, indirect detection, but maybe some of it would come to us as direct detection. The velocity is high, so it's kind of boosted. So I don't know. This is very, you know, kind of hazardous stuff to speculate about, because BB and ineffective constraints can get really bad, I think. So yeah, just very kind of crazy idea. Good. So I'm at the conclusion. So the underlying point is just that these hints of self-interactions can allow investigation of some cool dark matter physics. Elastic and inelastic scattering have qualitatively different features. It seems like there's a flat cross-section across many objects. If you want to do that with an elastic scattering, with elastic scattering, you need some relationship for the mass of the mediator. If you want to do that for inelastic scattering, you need some relationship for the binding energy of the in the dark sector. And just in general, I think that, you know, this gives us some really rich early and late universe stuff to think about. I'd say the unresolved issues, you know, the major stuff is, you know, how sure can I really be that there's fuel at late times that's able to do this kind of thing? And if I did that, can I be positive that it has an even kind of cold dark matter like cosmology? I have reasons to think that that's not crazy, but far from a proof. And then less major, but still important, you know, are there other observational signatures? How can I know this is the thing that I'm looking at? Whatever ideas you guys come up with, I will consider my own and then we'll be fine. Cool, thanks.
Questions for Sam?
So what, do you have a favorite model?
Mirror dark matter.
What is mirror?
Oh, it's just the exact standard model cup. No. I shouldn't have even said. I think there's many kind of non-minimal possibilities, and I think there's just a lot to think about. So,
I mean, you don't have one that's favorite. I mean, you must have one.
I think this kind of partial this partial fusion, like up to somewhere below, like the Iron Peak, you know, something that looks like getting good carbon.
Robert, unfortunately, the great Robert was here. So, like, what Robert and JMR did.
Yeah, that's that kind of.
Maybe more like what Matt and Chris did, right? Because they did Big Bang Dark Leo synthesis, and they also played around with this, what you can actually fuse up to, not being able to fuse all the way up the chain, depending on the numerics of something like you combine 3 to 2 within the thresholds of your annihilation. So this would be sort of what you would want. You would want to set it up so that you got some available states left.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry, I couldn't finish your
name.
Model.
Yeah. And well, so with Gordon and Chris Sigurdsson had this one. Yeah, they got a dark Leo synthesis, and they kind of like put it in like a cut. They just said we're not going to consider states above A of 20.
They didn't think it through. I don't think. I mean, I think the best. I mean,
Catherine's stuff is really good. I mean, like they've looked at what you can get, and UA's looked at what you can get. I mean,
those papers, the ones that looked at the evolution, they just get to really high numbers, nuclear numbers in the early universe, right?
But it's not entirely clear to me if that's what they are, if that's something that they're aiming for, and they kind of want to say, like, here's an exotic situation that we can come up with, and we get, you know, states of 10 to the 8 nuclei or something. Or if it's more generic in those models to just have something go up to A equals 5 in the early universe and then get to 10 later on. So I think it's untrivial.
I mean, the question is if there's a certain, I don't understand. I mean, I thought the only variables in those models were, I mean, you care about the interaction with the standard model, so that's one thing. But if you forget about the interaction with the standard model through the Higgs or whatever, it's just the nuclear cross-section, which I think they assumed was roughly geometric or something.
Mm-hmm.
So that seems pretty generic. And then you know what it is in the early universe. If you know what it is in the early universe, you know what it is in the late universe. So I don't understand how you can pick where you stop.
That depends a lot on the like size of alpha and the mass of the mediator. And
so then that
it depends
I think
on
you
the
can
structure, right? The reason that we have
it depends on the interaction with the standard model you're saying.
No, just the self-interaction cross-section.
Types of interactions you have for the nuclei, right? It's not like...
Yeah, I mean, the standard model doesn't do that. Like, the standard model doesn't go up to 10 to the 8 nuclei. Like,
no,
so the range of the interaction has to be big enough to...
So all I'm saying is I have one model for sure where I don't go up to A equals 10 to the 8, and that's the standard model.
Yeah, but we know
that's
that
got, like,
work for direct matter, probably. I don't know.
Well, no, we don't know that.
A
I mean,
cooling mechanism. So
we have a.
Yeah, there's a long
we have
range
a cooling. We have
force,
a
so
yeah. We have
work.
A long range force. If you just had mirrored world, I mean, you have problems. It doesn't.
That's
work.
True, but that's from degree of freedom counting. I think as much as anything else. So
what do you mean, degree
from
of
cooling,
no,
it's the process
cooling.
That you were
yeah.
saying that you have a photon.
Yeah.
Oh, that. Yeah. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. That doesn't work. So. So the question.
But you're saying, you know, we have a very long-range force in the standard model, but you only need to be long-range over the size of whatever your
yeah.
dark nucleus is.
Yeah.
So I don't have to have a super long-range force that's going to screw me cosmologically. It just has
yeah.
to be long-range over the size of...
Yeah. yeah. It's not Coulomb... So it's not Coulomb repulsion or something that is making this curve look the way it does, right? I mean, so we know that... There are, like, the iron peak is way above carbon. And so if I assume that every single process is in equilibrium here. So this has, in the standard model, the thing that...
There's several reasons why the structure. First of all, we have protons and neutrons, right? So they have different masses. There's an entire... There's
yeah.
a lot of reasons why the structure of the nuclei. It's not just... If you just had the bulk of neutrons
mm-hmm.
In the dark sector... Why is there, and they're stable, why is there a limit to how big you can get things to be?
Because you need to, because you're reducing the number density of particles as you fuse up, and
yeah.
you need some energy in order for particles to see each other. And so there's some competition between rates and Hubble. And
yeah,
so rates can freeze up
so that's the question.
Part of
the
way up the iron.
So in this very simple model, I just seem to do the numbers, and it's not obvious to me that if you set it so that the rates freeze out early on and you get a small number, then today they're big enough to have
yeah.
this.
I think, yeah.
It seems like a one, I mean, in a simple model, that would be a one parameter kind of estimate, and you can see if it works or not.
Yeah.
But in these geometric things that Robert and Catherine.
I think I agree with what you're saying.
And I think the mass of a dark nucleus to the binding energy, that ratio being large, is going to tend to help you, because then you'll be freezing things out earlier, or freezing out these sorts of processes earlier.
If the binding energy is small, the binding energy is large.
If the binding energy is small.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, so I think, yes, I think that there's some reasons for thinking that it's possible, and there's some reasons for thinking that it doesn't happen in every single case of a dark sector with interactions.
Makes sense.